Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weight loss. That's PlushCare.com/weight loss. PlushCare.com/weight loss.
Welcome to the Fighting on Film podcast, the podcast all about classic and obscure war movies, from the Normandy landings to the days of chivalry and swords. If it's been captured on film, we're going to try and cover it. I'm Robbie, of RM Military History.
I'm Matthew Moss, of Historical Firearms and the Armourer's Bench.
Hello, welcome back to Fighting on Film. This week is going to be a little bit of a departure from regular programming. As this week we're not reviewing a film, we are doing what we're dubbing Tropetastic. Now, we put it out on the Twitter feed a few weeks ago. So these are in no particular order, and I'm sure, as always, we will have lots of side chats and tangents, as we always do. So kicking off with Loathed Tropes from Dr. Kirsten McKenzie. She goes with Loathed Tropes, The Drunken Angry Irishman, not thinking of a certain TV series at all, or Jacobites as kilt clad and broadsword swinging. And her example was, I think that might be from the TV show Outlander, of some kilted chaps running with swords.
I mean, that's a classic though, isn't it, as well? I mean, even Watkins did kilted chaps with
swords. He did, didn't he? Yeah, he did.
I mean, to be fair to Watkins, he did give, you know, them a voice. It wasn't just they charged. Yeah.
No, that's a sad film, Culloden, isn't it?
It is, it is.
It's really sad. It's everything that War Game isn't, in a way. Mm.
But yeah.
Yeah, I'm not a big fan of, I wasn't a Peaky Blinders. Is that Peaky Blinders that Kirsten means there?
I've never watched it, you know. I didn't like it.
I've tried about three or four times to get into it. Everyone that I know, it's like,
YouTube keeps forcing clips onto me where it's like, here's Cillian Murphy saying something badass with that guitar riff that's like, like slide guitar. And I'm like, okay, now I don't need to watch Peaky Blinders because I've seen all of these scenes that none of them make sense to me, but.
So it's just everyone in that, all the only dialogue I ever seem to ever remember is, thanks, Tommy. You're a Tommy. Hey, you doing Tommy Led? It's just like,
there's probably a supercut somewhere of that.
People just ask like being nice to Tommy or asking how he is. Anyway.
I mean, it's not completely out of the realms because obviously there are World War One undertones to that show, aren't there? But yeah.
There's Lewis guns in the first episode. I remember that.
There's SMLEs and all sorts
lots
of
going on.
I've seen YouTube.
Don't they
clips that keep getting thrust on me?
Yeah, they end up having some doings with Oswald Mosley or something in the end, which I thought was quite interesting.
Fun.
It's because I was like, is it because to me? I mean, we're on tangent.
My God, we are 3 minutes in and we're on a massive tangent already.
I was like, well, I already watched When the Boat Comes In with Mark Bolan. When it was repeated on UK history years ago. And that was like enough. That was like Peaky Blinders for its day. And that's great. Like there's a
Proto Blinders.
Yeah, it's really good. If anyone hasn't seen it, it's fantastic. Right. Do seek it out. It goes from the 20s up until the 30s and deals with like social themes, political themes, very much Peaky Blinders-esque.
I haven't seen that either, but yeah.
He ends up going to fight in the Spanish Civil War, I think.
All right.
On the side of the international brigades.
Does he join the POOM?
He does. Join the POOM. Can't wait to do that one.
I know, we need to do it.
Anyway, moving on. Trope number two comes from World War II TV's Paul Woodage. Hello, Paul. Hope you're well. He goes, the big hulking bully put on his back by a smaller guy who knows unarmed combat. Oof. The malingerer who no one likes, who ends up letting everyone down. And a tense minefield scene, usually involving someone stepping in one and the hero diffusing it around his foot before it detonates.
Or in Robert Mitchum's case, throwing paving stones at them.
Christ, I'm never going to get over that. The minefield trope, though, is huge. Oh,
that's a huge one. I mean, that we've already threatened this, but that's a whole episode of its own
where we just talk about minefields.
Yeah. We get an EOD expert on for that, right?
Yeah. Oh,
and
that'd
we talk
be
about minefield tropes.
Yeah, that'd be brilliant. Yeah. That's a great one. If you know anyone knows, mine experts, get them.
Definitely. Get them going back to the first one Woody mentioned there, which was...
Big hulking bully put on his back by a smaller guy.
Yeah, there's loads of that, isn't there? Like, Dirty Dozen, where Marvin drops...
But I was getting confused there because when it said big hulking bully, I thought you meant like a piggyback. So I was thinking, now I realise it means put on his back, like laid out, like punched.
Marvin famously drops Franco in that the first time they meet. I think it's the Devil's Brigade, where there's a big dude that gets dropped by the sergeant. Jack Watson.
They redo that trope in the Dirty Dozen sequels, like every movie.
Oh yeah. Because every Dirty Dozen sequel is
the same
tropes
thing.
On tropes on tropes, isn't it?
I like the malingerer who no one likes, who ends up letting everyone down. I mean, that's an early Upham.
It is proto.
That's Upham.
You can flip that on its head, and you got Hook in Zulu. Who's
comes
a malingerer
good.
And comes good? Yeah.
Famously woefully misrepresented in that movie, so much so that his family walked out of the premiere. Yeah,
exactly. Yeah,
you know.
I mean,
that's a trope in itself. Yeah, that's a trope, isn't it? Misrepresenting actual people badly. Done a few times. Will it be done in Napoleon? Who knows? That's come out today. That trailer.
Oh yeah, that trailer is interesting, isn't it?
People are seething because he fired a cannon at the Sphinx, and it never happened. Apparently.
It didn't. Like, that's the big myth, isn't it? Like, he fires the cannon at the Sphinx's nose, and that's why it hasn't got a face.
I'm surprised no one's done a Joker Napoleon mashup yet.
It'll happen. Give
this is what
time.
You get when you exile a French emperor.
What else have we got?
And then we had a tense minefield scene. Favorite one is Anzio, because it's so absurd.
That can't be your favorite, though. I mean, you've got...
It is, because I'd never seen it before. And I've
got Kelly's Heroes.
It.
That's like the
that's great.
The most tense. I mean, every
that,
film
I don't like that scene.
One.
That's the scene that kills the movie dead for me a little bit, in Kelly's Heroes.
Yeah, I know what you mean.
Because it's just a bit absurd.
Yeah, could have been. We did talk about this in our discussion a bit in the past, haven't we? About how that minefield scene kind of like... They could have gone around that
easily. Yeah.
Yeah. I get the feeling like that there's a wall right there. Just walk along the wall.
Yeah.
You know.
So that I think we talked about that in our episode with it with Peter Caddick Adams. It's the one thing that doesn't make any sense. Now we have Tom W. He goes with the bit where a vastly outnumbered company doesn't surrender straight off the bat to a load of mercs, firing a Vickers upside down. And hand-loading Brens a small fry compared to the above.
Oh, Tom, I know what that... I know exactly what you're talking about there.
Siege of Yaddertville, for anyone who hasn't picked up on that one.
Yeah. Tom always loves mentioning that one. I mean, that film is... I enjoy it for what it is.
We both
enjoyed it. We talked about that pretty early on in the pod,
didn't we? One of Netflix's, like, I was pleasantly surprised with how well done it was. And I know there's some weird bits in there. Famously, like, went and did a whole day on a range.
Yeah, working Rich out and I, that have, you know, the Vickers Machine Gun Collection and Research Association got so River County about that one scene in the film that we literally went to a range with a brain gun and tested the practical accuracy of it. And we found that it was, you know.
I can't wait to do my baking tray armor plate testing.
Based entirely on one scene from
Phoenix Nights. From 2002. Is this bulletproof, Max? No, greaseproof.
Oh my god.
Amazing.
Very funny though.
And then Adrian Wheel, and I may have to read some of these out because I was amazed when these came out. When he messaged them us, when he put them in the thread, he put, these are the ones that piss me off in fury. And they are two, like, Word documents. And I'll read a few out, or we'll be here for a while.
Paragraphs.
It's fantastic. And they're so in-depth, and I love them. So he goes, the replacement crewman is not really a soldier, but a clerk typist who has been in the army for 8 weeks, has never seen combat, and is something of an idealist. See Saving Private Ryan and Black Hawk Down for more or less the same character. I think Upham type people really get to people, I think.
Yeah. But they intended to.
Yeah. It took me years to work out why Upham is the way that he is, because he's meant to be us. He's meant to be the viewer. Yeah. That's how I've always seen it.
I can see that. Yeah, but he's
out of the situation. He's not been. Like in these war films, you're picking up someone's career or someone's vocation. If you're a soldier, I mean, you know, you don't become a soldier lightly.
You dropped into the experience, aren't you?
Yeah, exactly. So it's the whole thing of they are meant to be us, and I always think him not doing. Killing when he should, and him not saving people when he should in that movie is—he's the only one with a conscience. He's showing how actually hard it is to take a life. But anyway, that's a discussion for another day. Now we have Brad's surviving crew comprised of three stock war movie characters, a Christian fundamentalist gunner, quite well played by Shia LaBeouf as it happens, a Latino driver, and a Southern redneck loader. They're all completely different, yet they love and respect each other, presumably through shared experience. Saving Private Ryan again, they could have substituted the Jewish soldier for the Latino to maintain the same cliche level. I love the casting of Fury, I just got to say it.
I do too. Great. And I mean, that is a trope within itself, casting those disparate characters and having them all come together, which is kind of, you know, based on reality of war, etc. And that is what happens. But you also see that in films like Hamburger Hill and lots of other Vietnam War movies where you see, well, I mean, even The Way Ahead, you take disparate group of people, force them together.
Yeah, crikey, The Other Way Ahead. Yeah, that's very true. Actually.
And you know, that is a trope of its own, definitely.
I mean, we can't mention a fight on film episode without talking about Nine Men, but it does the exact same thing. All those men are very much 40s cliches.
That won't be the first, and it won't be the last mention.
Bloody won't be. And then, so just round off quickly. And I know this one annoys a lot of people. Adrian and I do understand. Brad and the guys end up hopelessly defending a crossroads from their crippled tank against a quote-unquote battalion, actually more like a big company of fanatical Waffen-SS troops. The SS baddies are astonishingly tactically naive, despite superior firepower, and get their asses handed to them. But ultimately, fresh-faced new boy is the only survivor amongst the goodies, i.e. Saving Private Ryan. Yep.
Yep, I mean... You see, the thing about battalion sizes in films is you're paying extras, aren't you?
And
when you put those, like, when I thought it was fairly impressive that they put that many guys into the shots in that. And it is just like
it was company. Fanatical on how much he actually wanted in that movie. So there's a reason why that has so much stuff in it. Because Ayo is a real kid. He's an Ali Sally lover, basically. He loves Ali.
Yeah, essentially, yeah.
You know, there was things that, I mean, I know we went to the Fury experience. There were some really great chats and talks on the day. But I think David Willey mentioned...
Your episode on that if you haven't listened to it.
Yes, please do. In one of the talks, he mentioned that there was things in the movie that they had to really talk Ayo out of showing, because they're like, it might be cool, but there's no need for it.
Don't need it.
So,
yeah.
So there was
Wasn't
a, few
it a fuel
things...
kitchen? Didn't he want to like show an entire fuel kitchen?
He wanted like a whole kitchen and like, you know, people showing people doing laundry and things like that. And they were like, look, it would be great, but there's budget to think about.
And also storytelling.
Yeah, and I'll save it for the Fury episode. But I think personally, I think Fury, I mean, it might ruffle some feathers, but I think Fury is how you make a very competent mid-budget war movie or in any way a mid-budget film these days, because that's a very rare thing now. The movies, I mean, I know Sony Pictures had issues around it because it got leaked and whatever, but that for me, that movie is like almost the last of a dying breed of films we don't get anymore, but pre-streaming. I have a very interesting theory about Fury and how it actually is the last of a thing. But anyway, but I get why that ending annoys people, because obviously a disabled tank, you might hit it with a couple of Panzerfausts or whatever and walk off. You might just walk past it more often than not. You wouldn't bat an eye. But it's a great ending to the movie, isn't it, regardless?
It's beautifully shot. And I always say this, it's really beautifully shot. And you know what? It's the biggest trope of all. It's The Last Stand.
It is. It's a lot. It becomes a Last Stand movie, which is another thing I love about Fury. We should do that very soon. It's a very good film, I think. Anyway, moving on. Alistair Martin says, the typing pool clerk who has to learn to become a killer transformational arc.
Back to Fury.
Back to Saving Private Ryan as well.
It's
the Arpum episode, isn't it? It truly is. So many people.
Fuck them, but yeah.
We need to get that actor on. We need to get him on for in conversation.
Oh, that'd be great, actually.
Being Upham, he does a great job. Film. He really, really does.
He makes you fucking loathe him and be like, "Why are you doing this?" And then he makes you think, and that's that's a skill.
And he does kill Steamboat Willie, which is very cathartic at the end of that film. It's a very his arc's great.
It's quite an arc. It really is.
An arc.
The guy in Fury doesn't have his typewriter with him.
No, he doesn't. No.
Which is a shame.
The pencil bit is really great. I love that.
Yeah, that is good.
You get very rare Tom Hanks, I used to do comedy film look. You don't get
80s, early 90s Hanks comedy film look.
He somehow made us all forget that he started off in comedy.
I mean, he's got funny bits in his films, though, doesn't he?
They've done a good job masking the fact he was a comedy actor. Anyway,
I mean, have you ever seen the movie Dragnet with Dan Aykroyd?
Yeah, with Dan Aykroyd. Yeah, that's great.
So good.
Yeah.
Good film. It's so stupid, but I love it.
I like the money pit. I like him buying a house. That's funny. Then we have Campbell goes with the pregnant girlfriend / married after this trip death sentence.
Oof.
Never say that in a war film. Never say that in any film, regardless.
Anyone who looks, I was talking to Lauren about this, my partner, and whenever someone has a girlfriend at home or tells someone about having a girlfriend at home or looks at a photograph of someone of a girlfriend at home.
They do it in Hamburger Hill, the guy that gets the Dear John letter.
Yeah, that's
it. He gets a Dear John and then he's gone in a few scenes later. Yeah, happens a lot.
That is one of the single most prevalent tropes of any war movie.
Or like, never say you want to cruise the boulevard in your brand new Corvette or something.
Well, it's on par with retiring in a cop movie.
Oh yeah.
you're a dead man as soon as you get that retirement note through, you're dead. But yeah, that is one of the most prevalent. We had that in Anzio the week.
We did. Yeah, and Anzio is like getting a beating. Sari Thomas echoes the same sentiment where he goes, after the war, matey and I are going to move to Eastbourne and open a tea shop. Dead in the next scene. Fuel/ammo quantity is only ever an issue if the plot requires it. That's very true, actually.
Battle of the Bulge. Whole film is about Kessler trying to get to some fuel. I noticed that reloads were a common one that were mentioned in the thread. People never reloading. Regal's there.
Yeah, true.
There's a very little bit of reloading in The Wild Geese.
There's barely any in that. Oh, no, there's a really nice bit where...
There's the great where Hardy Kruger reloads.
When he's got the
prisoner on his back.
Oh, it's so good. Slapping that mag in. Oh, something sexual about that. Beautiful.
Why isn't there a gif of that?
Hot reload action. That'd be our OnlyFans, wouldn't it? It'd just be gifs of reloads.
That would be it. Yeah.
And then he goes with British officers in American films are usually incompetent upper class twits. I mean, Band of Brothers does that to a T for me.
Yeah.
That tanky officer. Yeah, Bridge Too Far as well. That does it. Oh Christ, yeah. Same, it's the same thing, isn't it? I just realized that.
Bridge Over the River Kwai.
Yeah, Bridge Over the River Kwai does that a lot. Yeah.
Kind of looks down on Alec Guinness's character, don't they? Is being like insanely stiff upper lip.
I like that's why I like Yesterday's Enemy, because it doesn't have that trope in it. It has, you know, Stanley Baker is a sort of, you think he's worked his way up from the ranks, even though he's a tiny bit clipped. He doesn't seem like he's like a career officer, but he's got all these clipped people around him that are sort of, he's subverting that. I really like that one. And if anyone hasn't seen that,
that's another mini trope. I can't think of any examples of it off the top of my head, but people proving themselves to posher upper class officers.
Yeah, that's fair. Yeah.
There's a few.
Yeah, there is. No, I can't.
There's subtext.
There's subtext there. And then he ends with, any film with Cage is shite. Any film, Seri. Seri hates.
Any film.
You heard it here first.
Any film.
Seri does not like Nicolas Cage.
What about Lords of War?
Yeah, that's good. I like that one.
It's not a bad film. Yeah. I mean, he's a bit insufferable in it.
I tongue in cheek enjoy Windtalkers, but it is trash, you know.
Cage isn't the worst thing in that film. That's the one thing.
It's not. Christian Slater's paper mache head is. Kevin Getz goes with the soldier who receives a letter to the fiance is going to be dead. Then classic. Stephen O'Neill, and this was Dissent Among the Ranks, listeners, and I was in control of the Twitter on the day this went out, and he said, "Un petit peu," which is a reference to Nine Men.
It's not a trope,
but I put that bit.
I defy anyone to show me another instance where "un petit peu" is used in a film in a trope-like manner.
I put that better not be Nine Men slander in the ranks. And then
perhaps he's referring to like stiff upper lip.
I think that might be it.
Read the core type stuff.
But that bled into, doesn't it? That bleeds into maybe every 50s, 60s British film that there is some sort of stiff upper lip in there anyway. Ian McKellen now goes with radar screens that make a bleep noise when the plot appears on the PPI screen. Radar screens that only show one plot and zero clutter. Nobody cleans their weapon. Every wound needs a tourniquet. And POW camps only showing officer prisoners.
That's true. That is true. I feel like he has a personal thing with the radar experience.
I think it's Ian's ex-RAF, I think. So
he is, yes.
Definitely. There were a few more radar type ones. But I didn't know any of that about radars. So no, that's useful to know.
Well, I mean, perhaps we need to have Ian on for an episode where we talk about radar in war movies.
Yeah, radar roundup. AD Bonds goes with four-blade Spitfires for any Battle of Britain stuff.
Yeah, yeah.
That's what you think, yeah.
Spitfires in place of Hurricanes.
Yeah, yeah, agreed. Yeah. Isn't you reusing Battle of Britain footage a trope as well? Loads of films do it, and they still
and
do
also,
it.
And also mosquito footage from 63. Squadron.
Yes.
Or Mosquito Squadron, one or the other.
And
one way around.
And the bombing of Hamburg, bomb dropping footage being used quite a lot. I've seen that a lot of times, either colorized or not. It's used in Memphis Belle as well.
Mm.
Then we have two soldiers who dislike each other. From Brian Williams, this is. He goes with the other, the recruit who passes around a photo of his girl back home. That's quite a prevalent one from everyone. Then we have two soldiers who dislike each other but who become friends after friends under fire, one of whom will die in the other's arms.
Legionnaire with Jean-Claude Van Damme has a little bit of that going on.
It does, yeah. I mean, Wild Geese does it, don't they? I mean, they kind of subvert that where Kruger doesn't like the president,
Kruger's character,
but then they come to like each other.
Yeah, that whole grudging appreciation kind of thing is.
I feel like Long the Short and the Tool has that in it, but not the cradling each other. They just grow to respect each other when they're going to get attacked.
Zulu.
I want to say that's in there. Definitely Zulu.
Richard and Bromhead.
A few minutes of history now. He goes with snooty British officers. Quote unquote. I'm glad I died for my country. Every Englishman being from London. Dreadful berets and NCO back chatting officers.
Dreadful berets doesn't seem possible.
every beret in every film is fantastic. What are you talking about?
I've got a few examples of that one actually. Chard in Zulu for the officer being rather clipped and an officer and a gentleman type.
Well, that's more classism than anything else, I think.
Well, of course it is, dear boy. Anson in Ice Cold.
Anything David Niven did war related.
Yes.
He was playing David Niven.
Yes, he was. But away from like the English gentleman trope, you've got like a broader trope of just officers and commanders that are portrayed as like stand-up dudes.
Yeah, like, it's nothing. They can't
like
do the thing wrong.
In Greyhound, you get the feeling that Hanks's character is you know, he's a good chap.
Yeah, he's an all-round slugger. Yeah, he's a great guy. Yeah, yeah.
Mel Gibson does the same thing with Hal Moore in We Were Soldiers. There's a plethora of that one.
The every Englishman coming from London thing. I think that's an Ealing studio thing. Like everyone, that's almost like they mirror each other. So you got the snooty people are like your main actors, and then everyone else underneath them is like your Percy Herberts and your
Everyone's salt. Everyone below the captain is salt of the earth.
Yeah,
essentially.
All right, Gov. I'll stand this river and fight the Jerrys. It's always like that, isn't it?
Yeah.
But that feeds into my thing.
The entirety of Zulu, you mean? But yeah. But it's Welsh.
Exactly. Yeah. That
which famously, it wasn't a Welsh regiment at the time. So,
no. Yeah, exactly. Weird, isn't it? But that feeds into my thing of every kid in like British media is a little oik from London.
Oh, very true. Yeah. Very true. Personified by those kids in The Universal Soldier when they're picking up their small arms.
Is that a real gun? Is that a real gun, mister? Maybe when we do Hope and Glory, that might be different. But I think then they're in London, aren't they?
Yeah, they are. Yeah.
Ooh. Oh, yeah, because the balloon comes down, don't they? And the Home Guard come and shoot it. And they go, oh, it's ruined our fan. Oh, Christian Bale. Is it Christian? No, it's not Christian Bale, is it?
It's not. That's surprising. Whatever that film's called.
Cry Through the Sky. Cadillac of the Sky.
That's it, yeah.
Because that one doesn't do it, does it? The Christian Bale one. He's quite clipped in that.
He is. Well, he's supposed to be, I think he's a banker's son in that, isn't he? Or a merchant's son. He's definitely very posh.
This is a good one from Bill 1940 Medal Campaign. Grenades that explode with the power of the Hiroshima bomb. Ooh.
Yeah. Oh, there's almost a lot of that in Wind Talkers.
Wind Talkers made that.
I think what happened is John Woo on that film went, I'd like some pyro for some hand grenades. And the pyro guy just turned around and said, no worries, John, I got you.
Yeah.
And he went and just used the largest fuel-based explosion he could.
I always envisage it as the pyro guy made a very realistic explosion, and Wu turned around like Kylo Ren in Star Wars and just went more. That's what that movie feels like.
Yeah,
but that is true. Like I always think that our sort of like cultural touchstone for grenades is that they go off really big, but they don't really.
They don't, no.
No.
I mean, it depends on the type of grenade. Like blast grenades more so than others.
Another thing is like when people get shot, they don't just crumple into a heap. They like get thrown back and like you put their arms up and all that.
Well, that is a good trope, actually. Yeah. When people do super dramatic deaths from gunshot
wounds. Like that one for Operation Overlord where he does the whole.
Where he does a jig before he falls over.
Yeah.
Christ. We need
he
to do that.
Tap dance before he dies. But that's
year,
a good one.
Next
though.
Year for D-Day, Rob. Big anniversary. Next big anniversary. We're gonna do Operation Overlord.
Yeah, we should. Yeah. We'll do an Overlord month. We could do a D-Day month. That's enough to do.
Easily.
Then we have one which is very true and prevalent, and it is a fault of cinema, really. An almost complete absence of Canadians and Anzacs. Well, I think there's more Australian representation in war movies than there is Canadian. Barely any.
Yeah, I mean, Devil's Brigade is about the only...
Devil's Brigade, there's a film, a made-for-TV film, about Canadian convoy crews.
Okay.
It was made in the 90s, but that you'd have to. Yeah. I had to track that down when I heard about it. I can't, there's no Dieppe film, is there?
No, there should be.
No, there is. There's a Dieppe series, wasn't there? A TV series in the 90s as well. Yeah, there is, yeah. Because if I don't say it, Alex Bowers or on this day in Canadian history will put us straight on this. So we have to be right. Because, you know, there are some good historians out there at the moment doing what media should have done years ago is show all these interesting battles. Where's your Toner movie? Come on.
Yeah.
Imagine a Monte Cassino film where you get everyone has a little troop of, you know, you show some Poles, show some Brits.
Mm-hmm.
It'd be great. You know, just sort of like Commonwealth or Free Nation representation would be nice in war films. I mean, I know there's this Polish one coming out, isn't there, that caught some flack online a few months back.
I mean, everyone looks at like production stills of films and goes, well, that doesn't look great, does it?
They did it with Napoleon.
They did.
When it came out. Yeah. But no, I do agree with you there, Bill. A big absence of other nations that aren't British or American. I think that as well, that boils down to film industry and how much money you've got to put into projects as well. Mm. The notoriety you can gain by doing so. Anyway, Liam Patrick goes with, he goes with no British or other nations or in American war films. The hero being the only one to have good ideas, but everyone is stupid, inept, or unknowledgeable. And then he goes national stereotypes like the British tank scene in Band of Brothers. And then I guess slash. Yeah,
David Manet mentions Scotsmen always being drunks.
That's true. Yeah. Yeah. That's there's a lot of horrible stereotyping going on.
There is. Stereotypes are very prevalent in a lot of 50s, 60s war movies. And they continue to be a little bit, don't they? But yeah.
Yeah, Paul Hicks goes with the why the insanity guy.
Oh my god! For some reason, when you read that, I the Bill Nye the Science Guy theme flashed through my head.
Why the insanity guy?
But yeah, the classic one of that is the blonde chap in Waterloo where he pops out the infantry square with his shako in one hand and his musket in the other, and he's like. Why? Yeah. And then gets killed by a cuirassier or something.
Yeah, they do that really early in Saving Private Ryan without doing it, without saying it, where Miller has the sort of been hit by the shell near him, and he is the ringing in his ears, and he's looking around at all these little cliched moments of men getting shot and the guy picking up his own arm. I feel like that's the bit
I think that bit's quite
powerful.
Good,
but I feel like it's the movie going, war isn't very nice, is it? It's that whole bit.
Oh, so that was Spielberg going, well, it's not very nice, but now enjoy the next 20 minutes of lads like killing people.
I feel basically. Like that's what that is. I feel like that whole opening sequence is to remind you of how like horrible war is for half an hour until it completely changes the movie that it is.
It's totally, interesting. Totally, that movie is wild.
How much of a tonal shift that happens in like 10 minutes is
that
amazing.
That film goes from being like just shock to a road movie to a last stand in so many hard turns. It's wild.
It's A, B, and C, but B is a tiny little B, and A and C are huge. old actor Giles Pocklington goes with old actors playing young soldiers, e.g. Van der Voort was 27, John Wayne was in his 50s. Kind of like that one.
Yeah, that's a good one. You get a lot of that. I mean, there's so many old actors playing roles that were definitely young men.
Definitely, yeah.
Again, struggling to think of them off the top of my head, but like, goddamn, there are so many of them.
You get brain block. You get mental block.
You really
block.
Do.
We've
you
done
really
like 150 do. Odd movies nearly on this show. Oh, yeah. And sometimes I forget what we've done and what we haven't done. So I will re-watch a movie and going, oh, this greatest film's great. We're still on the show. And Matt always goes, oh, we've done it. We did it like 2 years ago.
I'll just drop you the link.
Exactly. It's like, well, you'll
love this podcast about Rob.
Yeah. This reviewer called R. Maguire. He had some thoughts.
I think sometimes we should just record the episode without one of us telling the other, and then find out if our opinions have changed.
That should do that. Yeah, when like a reality series does a "Where Are They Now" thing or what happened after revisiting episode.
Oh my god! Yeah,
do that. Yeah. Do that. Kieran Taylor, and this I think this is prevalent to historiography as well, not just war films. Where he says every German tank being a tiger, and then the characters going on about the sounds of the 88s. That's a very cultural social thing, isn't it?
It is. Every panther's a tiger and every tiger's a panther.
Yeah, exactly. Everything's a tiger. Yeah.
Yeah. Every armored vehicle's a panzer kind of thing. But you can understand where it comes from. I mean, you see it in after action reports, war diaries, and all sorts. It's just the way of talking about armored vehicles, doesn't it?
That whole thing of Kane took out two tigers on his own in Arnhem, and it's like, no, they were Stugs. Like, they were definitely SPGs, and that's no mean feat. And this is the
exactly
whole thing.
When you say that, like, no, didn't, like, you're not like belittling what he did.
Yeah,
you're like,
'cause this is my whole thing. It's like, what? It's not easy to do that anyway. It's not easy to take out an armored fighting vehicle on your own.
No, I wouldn't want to take on a Stug.
With a Pea at point-blank range.
I mean, they're just as dangerous as a Tiger to an infantryman, let's face it.
Exactly. And because this is a bigger discussion, but it takes away what people do when they engage any armoured fighting vehicle in anything, whether you're in a tank, a scout car, on your own with a Pea or a bazooka or whatever. It's almost like we're saying, oh, well, it was easy then because it wasn't this mythical tank.
Yeah.
It's like bollocks. It's hard. Like, it's really, you know, you've got tons of metal and a gun with, you know, with a gun attached to it coming at you. Fury is that, isn't it? There's no other tanks in Fury that are, they is tigers, isn't it? That's another trope as well, or a sort of half truth mythology where it goes, you just swarm a tiger with like 10 Shermans and you kill it that way. And it's like, do you really?
I'd like to see that.
That's as history as we've ever gotten on the show. And that was another one. Darren Skerritt echoed the same, where he said every fucking German artillery piece is an 88 and every German soldier has an MG-42. Again,
yeah,
every have done that.
Oh, that feeds into that classic trope of every German soldier is armed with an MP-40 and he's wearing, if it's cold, he's wearing his great coat. And if it's not cold, he's wearing like pristine Fieldgrau.
The Fieldgrau uniform. I fucking love that trope. I love that. Yeah. Even in,
he's got an MP40 with K98K pouches.
Yes, I love that trope. That's one of my favourite tropes. People having this, and that it's like a rivet counter.
Kelly's Heroes.
Yes, yeah. any 60s thing usually. I love it. I love seeing. I'm like,
it's great.
Where's his pouches? But I'm like, where's his extra mags? Where are they?
Same with Thompson's, like Thompson's US guys, well. Thompson's with their Garand pouches, but that, you know, they're running around with a Thompson.
That was one of the few things in Anzio that I liked. The lads had Thompson pouches. That was good.
Yeah, well done, Anzio.
Well done, Anzio. Did something right.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. WarbyParker.com/covered.
Hello there. Sorry to interrupt. I wanted to let you know that you can now join our supporting cast over on Patreon. As thanks for your support, you'll be able to help us pick films, submit questions for guests, have first pick on brand new and exclusive merch, and much more. Thank you for your support. Now back to the show.
There we have Sir Fatius Pauper. Some great Twitter names, guys. Token Brits being slow, snobby, unnecessarily callous, making tea. People, I've got to clear this up, right? It's not like 30 Corps' fault that they were slow. It's not. They were worried about getting absolutely wrecked before they got in to help the paratroopers. I've got to clear that up. Like, it's not fair. This is another thing we need to talk about on the show.
What do you mean
often.
That Bridge Too Far isn't a fully accurate movie?
Exactly, but this is where it comes into, because
I tell you what, when we cover A Bridge Too Far, Rob, we're really going to lay it.
We've already done it. We did it with Al.
Oh God, of course we have. Yeah. Oh yeah.
But this is the whole thing that war movies do, and it lends itself into a wider discussion again. But that whole thing of stopping having tea was so prevalent, and still is, and it's because of A Bridge Too Far, it's because of Banner Brothers. They're really hammering it home that you have to blame someone. It's this whole blame culture around Arnhem that I find and I research it. We always feel like we have to blame someone for it. I know it's the British's fault because they stopped. Well, what happens when you get to the bridge? Can you keep that corridor open with a dwindling amount of resources? It's a tough ask anyway. So one tank stopping at one bridge isn't the issue with that operation. It's a real Hail Mary thing anyway, but it is funny that that always comes up.
Before we move off of that one, we've got to talk about tea. Got to.
Tea is a heavy trope.
It's constant, isn't it? It's like there's a good stream. Every decade has a classic brewing up tea sequence.
Goes too far. Brown, Sean Connery, you think all this can be alleviated with a cup of tea? Great line. Yeah. Fantastic.
Steel Bayonet, where Logan's Batman comes out with a cup of tea. And gets killed.
Brilliant. Cruel Sea, tea in nice little enamel mugs, nice little china mugs in that. That's nice.
Mm-hmm. There's a little bit of it in, I'm trying to think of the exact World War One movie where there's a tea sequence.
Oh, Journey's End.
Yeah, Journey's End is the one that came to me first, but I think there's also that. I mean, it kind of is Journey's End, but the Ace is High as well.
Yeah, very true. Do that in that one. Yeah, tea is again, it's a cultural touchstone, isn't it? Something that
it totally is.
Guzzle the stuff.
I feel like in Greyhound, someone brings him a cup of tea as well.
Oh, it's coffee. No, it's coffee. It's American. It's coffee. The guy again, the guy with the dog, the wife who gets married is killed. And then a stalwart, reliable NCO played by Sean Bean who sticks it to the Ruperts. I'll whisper it. I've still not seen much Sharp.
Shocking. Absolutely appalling.
Sorry, everyone.
Quintessential 90s ITV programming that you have not watched.
I'm sorry. Chris Langdon goes with their least favourite, RAF pilots with posh boy accents. Yeah, I've got to agree there. And then most favourite, every NCO is furious, always.
Always.
The Way Ahead.
Guns of Patazi.
Yeah, Guns of Patazi. Oh, Christ, yeah. We should have like NCO offs maybe one day.
Oh, totally. That's definitely a format that we should explore.
NCOs films, because I think that Richard Attenborough's, I forget the guy's name in it, Christ, the actual character's name, but him in that, and then The Way Ahead's, I played Doctor Who.
Well, his name's Fletcher in that, but it's...
And William Hartnell, him in Attenborough. You'd be polishing your buttons and pulling your boots when they told you, Christ.
You would. I mean, and then you've got Sergeant Bourne in Zulu. Brilliant NCO portrayal of going from fairly quiet and measured to really bawling. Jumping off the back of that, one of my favourites is the veteran instructor. Fletcher in The Way Ahead. Watson in Nine Men.
Mm-hmm.
Similar sort of thing. Gunny Highway in Heartbreak Ridge.
Sandy from Wild Geese.
Sandy in Wild Geese. Sergeant Plumley in We Were Soldiers.
Oh, yeah. Some great ones,
Has a little bit of it going on.
See, what I noticed there is a through line of being played by, like, beloved character actors.
You're right.
Yeah.
And I feel like Percy Herbert was robbed of his chance to do that.
Was. I'm sure he did it somewhere, we've just not covered it yet.
That is a good shout. I mean, it's possible.
Yeah. Bill Hall goes with, for movies showing the Canadians, the formation always has one French Canadian, one First Nations soldier, people who are polite, self-effacing, but competent. And that feeds into Canadian stereotypes there.
Very few Canadian war movie portrayals.
Again, yeah, not very many. Then we have James Cooper. Goes with The Bridge Too Far. Artillery Barrel, Chasing the Woods is about the only film that shows German medics. 99% of films show Germans dying when shot, yet Allies have a far higher percentage of wounded when hit. That's very true, actually. Yeah.
It's interesting. That had never really occurred to me. But
no, that's very fair. Sense. If you're German infantryman number 5 running into shot, you're getting downed. But yet if you're... Mm-hmm. If you're Bren Gunner assistant named actor number 2, we're thinking of Steel Bayonets here. You can take a round, but you can valiantly take on more Jerrys before you're downed. That's very true, actually.
Yeah.
Absolutely. Never thought about that, Trey. That's a really good one.
That's a good one. That is a good one. What about The Good German?
Yeah, there's a few.
That's one of my faves.
Stalingrad subverts that, though. Got to admit.
It does. It does, kind of. You've got... Paul Lutz in Ice Cold. You've got the Italian chap in Sahara.
Yes, I've got about him. Crikey, yeah. We'll have to do Sahara soon. That's a great one.
Yeah, it is great. We've kind of got Kruger in Bridget Remargan. The criteria for The Good German kind of floats a little bit.
There's the film The Good German with George Clooney.
I have not seen it.
I think that might just be the name of it. It's just come into my head because you said good German. That's all I can think about.
But it's basically, you know, like
the, no, it is. It's
the,
true. Yeah.
It subverts the evil, you know, bad guy character into being someone that is relatable. Sometimes it's through interaction with the allies, or sometimes it's through the character being depicted as noble, such as, you know, with Kruger. You get that a little bit in a few different films.
He's a good German as well, but also, I mean, it's also perhaps a argument to be made that anyone who's portrayed to be in the Hitler Youth is an innocent party.
Like, I mean, there's an interesting scene in Downfall, isn't there, where he the wounded German soldier berates a group of Hitler Youth that are manning an AA gun. Again, it's an 88. Why the hell some Hitler Youth would be manning an 88? I don't know.
I know, right? They failed to show all the Volkssturm running off in that movie as well.
But no, I can understand where you're coming from with that.
Because it's because, like, Jojo Rabbit, like, it portrays them as, like, they're really innocent
There's
children.
An interesting depiction of Hitler Youth in Bridget Remargan, isn't it? Where the young boy that works at the hotel opens fire on the Americans with an MP40 from the window. Blameless. It kind of just portrays him as, like, child thrust into war kind of thing.
Mm. Yeah, it's always that children are always used in that thing. That's an interesting trope.
Yeah, like with that's similar to Full Metal Jacket.
Oh yeah.
The young girl at the end that Joker
young
kills.
Young Vietnamese sniper. Yeah. That's interesting. See, these tangents are quite, we get quite deep when we want to. Then we have Ian Anderson. Let's not forget the guy who cracks under pressure, but then composes and redeems himself of that mental break by performing some miraculous or superhuman feat, saving his comrades. Example, Johan from Das Boot, but I'm sure there are more. I just can't think of any others right now.
See, it's hard thinking of the examples.
It's difficult, isn't it? Because I was a bit mean to the listeners where I was like, please provide an example.
So was I.
Yeah.
And again, come back to Upham, that kind of subverts that trope in an interesting way almost. Yeah, I know where that one's coming from.
Oh, Christ. I've watched so many war films, I can't remember. God, I feel like that last ever Michelin Web sketch where they did the Sherlock Holmes when they were old, and he's like, I can't remember anymore, Watson.
Oh, God, he's like, I've solved so many crimes.
That's the most, like, the most poignant, sad way to end a sitcom ever, but I feel like that right now. I've seen so many war films. I can't remember.
Well, that's how we'll end the show when we finally finish.
Oh my God, yeah.
When we've finally done the last war film.
The lights are going out, Matthew, and I can't quite turn them back on again.
The mic's turning off, Rob.
The Zoom account's running out, Matthew. I can't quite renew it.
Patreon doesn't exist in 2073.
These hologram pods are killing us, Matt. Keep telling you, we need to invest.
Oh my God.
Crikey. Steve BG again goes with guns that never run out of ammo and Germans who can't hit targets. I mean, agreed. They become stormtrooper-esque shots, don't they? Whenever they need to.
I mean, I always wondered whether Lucas was subverting that trope with the stormtroopers not being able to hit anything a little bit.
I always thought it was because of their helmets, because they can see fuck all.
We'll have to ask him when he comes on.
Yeah. And they don't have a stock on the blaster, do they?
They don't. If they deployed the E-11's stock, then they'd have
You mean the Blastech E-11, that's what you mean.
I just said E-11. They'd have a much better chance of hitting the target they're aiming at.
Because the rebel troops have on their, I can't remember the name of the blaster, but the one that's mocked up on AR-15s or SG-44s, they have stocks. So that's why they're good shots.
I'm sure that the blasters that they mock up from, this another tangent about Star Wars guns, god damn it.
Fuck me.
I'm sure that the rebels have sights on their Sterling.
Yeah, they have little sights, don't they? I've never seen them using them though. But anyway, no guns are never run out of ammo. That's a great trope. My friend always made me laugh where he was always like, "Oh, I'd love to see these 60-foot magazines that war movies have, because you never see anyone reload." And I was like, "It's true." And Germans who can't hit targets is a good one. German snipers always can in movies though. They always.
Well, that's it. I was about to say, like, snipers in movies. That never miss.
True.
Like the dude in Kelly's Heroes with that Mosin Nagant and the sniper in Saving Private Ryan. He doesn't miss until a flat gun knocks him out.
Stay down. Boom. Great scene. He's weird left-handed. reloading.
No, that's that, they're all the hand signals he's giving to Tom
Hanks.
Oh,
yeah. He sees Panzer tanks, two of them. Tiger tanks, two of them. And I'm like, but Panzer tank, I always I always laugh at that because obviously like Panzer is shown for tank. So I'm like, I always imagine tank tanks. He sees tank tanks.
Yeah.
DJS goes with another history-based one. Not a sniff that the American Army in World War II was racially segregated. Rarely shown. I mean, I know there were a couple of movies that touch on it. There's Gopher Broke that
there's
show
that one about the Red Eye Express as well.
Red Bull Express, that's another one. And then there's quite a few Korean War movies in the 50s that deal with post-segregation. There's one with Alan Ladd and Sidney Poitier that I always forget the name of.
I always think of Porkchop Hill as a good one for that.
Porkchop Hill as well, yeah. That's definitely there. I read about it the other day and I thought, oh, wow, yeah, that was meant to be coming out. Denzel Washington was meant to either be directing or starring in a movie about the Red Bull Express. But I don't think it's happened yet. Or if it was going to happen, it might have missed its window. But that's interesting. Mm. Yeah, that's a good one.
Hope that didn't fall foul of COVID.
No, maybe not. I mean, he'd be a bit old now to be playing a frontline trooper. So maybe he was going to direct. Anyway. Unbelievable explosions, never-ending gunfire, terribly inept enemy tactics. Again, that one comes up a lot. Utter lack of what must be done after the shooting stop. Yeah, kind of agree there. You never really see soldiers just relaxing or chilling out as much as you should, I think, either, really. You're always on, aren't you?
And I mean, when it does, it's always used as an opportunity to either contextualize the characters or for a little bit of exposition, isn't it?
Yeah. Yeah, you never see anyone like cleaning weaponry after a firefight, like pull-throughs. And
when you do, it's good, though.
Yeah, you do. Yeah. It's nice when you see it, but you don't see it very often. And he says his favourite is an insouciant. I mean, I cut out when me and Matt were trying to work out how you pronounce that word. almost always a Brit, but excellent small command leader. Yep, I like it. And then we have Mike Builder Sim on Twitter. He goes, there is Tex. We call him Tex because he's from Texas. And there's Luigi. He's from Brooklyn. And all he talks about is the Dodgers. And here's Schmitty from Pittsburgh, George from California, Sully from Boston, Stanley from Iowa. It's weird. Like, American characters are boiled down to the state they come from, but British characters are boiled down to their class. Or what job they did.
I mean, I suppose, there isn't a class element with American localized portrayals because They're never shown as like upper class, you know. Like,
yeah, that's very true.
All of those tropes that were listed off then are all kind of like working class Joes, aren't they?
Mm.
And the one movie that does kind of like flip down its head in a weird way is Rough Riders, because the four or five characters that you follow in that, they're all rich New Yorkers.
Mm. Oh yeah,
like heirs to big money, that kind of thing.
Yeah, I like what Forrest Gump does with that, where it's like we got Tex from Tex and Tex. So I didn't know where he was from. Always makes me laugh. Great line, great writing.
Ian Anderson suggests the likable side character, often wearing glasses, possibly religious, has some eccentric quality, and or is a friend of the main character and gets killed off by the end. That's right. Another one that Lauren mentioned. Like, anyone who wears spectacles either gets them broken or gets killed. So, I mean, Ian mentions Cat in All Quiet on the Western Front.
Yes.
Private Jackson in Saving Private Ryan.
Yeah.
Bible in Fury, Shia LaBeouf's character.
Yeah.
Benjamin Bufford Blue, Bubba in Gump.
Mm-hmm.
And Danilov in Enemy at the Gates. And they're all true. Really good examples.
Yeah, there aren't.
Again,
I can't think of any
in the latest
All
Quiet on the Western Front, that happens again, where you know the chap with the glasses is the first of the group to be killed off.
It's interesting. Mm. Yeah, maybe the filmmakers see you as more, I don't know, it's more hard hitting or something. Perhaps, I don't know. Maybe then we have Campbell goes with Chekhov's gun taken too far. See Memphis Belle's. They've only got one wheel down, opening to final landing scene. That's funny.
Yeah, that is true.
That's too much in that film. They've already gone through way too fucking much.
Oh, I know.
On their mission. So then when I think, oh no, they can't get the landing gear down. Oh, they're not going to make it. And I'm like, all of the cast who've survived are in the plane. They're going to be fine, right? They're not.
Could have been a huge curveball, though, Rob.
Huh?
Could have been a huge curveball.
Could have been a huge curveball.
All died in a fiery mess.
But then you look how long the movie's got left.
God knows that happened.
Be fine. No, it must have done. Yeah. But it's very funny.
I Drink and I Know Things, another great Twitter handle, suggests characters that keep their cigars lit throughout combat sequences.
Yeah, that's true.
Yeah, and like it's obviously it's a continuity thing, but anyone with a fag in their mouth, like they never accidentally drop it, or it's always perfectly lit. You know, mm-hmm, it always stays mm-hmm. like a little stubby, little ciggy in your mouth. Oh yeah, this is one that I want to ask you about, obviously, because you're a firearms historian, so it's your bread and butter. So you might, does it annoy you or not? Daniel Michael says, not specific to war movies, but certainly well represented in them, guns just loudly click every time they move.
Yeah, I mean, Danny's got a point there. I mean, you see it in action movies. Anything that involves a gun.
He goes,
yeah. I love it in The Simpsons where they always show like a double barrel shotgun and they always like have the pump action sound over it. It's like,
yes.
That's one of another my favorite trope. Visual audio gags.
Does that annoy you though? I think that's just a movie trope in general.
I mean,
why do we do that anyway? Is it because it's
there's two sides of it, isn't there? Like there's the trope of like overly cocking things.
Yeah. Yeah.
Like when you're clearly just ejecting a live round.
I pissed my friends off with that. I'm like, he's just got rid of a round there. What's he doing that for?
Yeah, exactly. that irritates me.
Yes.
But if Danny means like guns that are, you know, rattling and making noise all the time. Mm. No, I don't. I always think that's a nice inclusion in like the, you know, the Foley side of things. Like they've thought.
Oh,
about
you like that? Okay. I always think it's funny. I just think it's a funny thing. Like getting a piss, like, like what the what?
Oh no, it's gotta be like sounds that would make sense. So like drawing it from a holster, like the rattle of it against.
It's like a vision, it's like an audio little sort of sound cue.
Like it can't
be
they pull the pistol and then it makes the sound of it.
I've heard that though.
Without them doing it.
But I've had that in ridiculous. Like someone's like put a pistol up to someone and it makes like a click sound.
Yeah. No, that's
right. It's so weird. I like that though. I quite like that trope. I like that personally. I like that one.
It's a good trope. It's a funny trope, but it's a bit irritating.
Mm-hmm. We've got Bill 1940 Medal Campaign again says Stalin uniforms always fit perfectly. I like that
very
too.
Very good. That's very true. Good. Yeah.
Yeah. Will
Guns
says banging
Navarone and,
Guns you know. Navarone. Yeah, that's a good one for that one.
Tobruk.
Guns, Tobruk. Yeah, Tobruk again. That's a good one. Yeah, I remember you said Guns Navarone. I always get Guns Navarone mixed up with Where Eagles Dare. For some reason.
Yeah,
in my head.
There's a vibe. There's a vibe. There's a through vibe.
Then we have Will goes with banging a magazine on the helmet. That's in a lot of NAM films, like Apocalypse Now. They do a lot. Is there a reason for it?
It's to seat the rounds into the magazine. Like
that's it.
The idea is that you tap the back of the magazine and the rounds will align and sit against the back, so they'll in theory feed.
It looks
reliably.
Cool as well for your character
It does look cool. And I always wondered whether it was kind of coming off the back of, you know, the Japanese hand grenades that they primed by banging them.
All those things, yeah.
I always wonder whether someone
grenades
seen
fizzing
that.
As well. That's another trope. Grenades like
some do
fizz,
like,
do they?
Yeah, it depends on the kind of fuse, but not many. Really does depend on the kind of fuse there. But
so there were some of your tropes. Thanks for getting involved, everyone. I'm sorry if we didn't get to yours.
Really, some really good.
We can
ones.
Always do another one of these. We thought we'd end. I'll ask Matt his favorite and his worst, and then he'll do the same for me. So Matt, your favorite trope.
My favorite is the sociopath psychopath
mm-hmm.
character. So we got Savalas' maggot in Dirty Dozen, Animal Mother in Full Metal Jacket, Barnes in Platoon,
yep.
Spears in Band of Brothers almost,
mm-hmm.
Trombley in Generation Kill. And arguably, I think one that's interesting is Lawrence in Lawrence of Arabia.
Oh yes.
Where he kind of, where he kind of like begins to enjoy
doing the carnage. What he's doing.
Yeah. The scene, the basically the chain ambush scene where he, you know, kind of becomes engaged.
I like for that. I watched it the other day. Listeners will have seen. But Beach Red, Rip Torn plays a grizzled sergeant in that, and he's like the stereotypically grizzled sergeant. That film's interesting. It feels like an exploration of tropes. So he's very much like, the captain tells him at one point in the movie that he shouldn't be killing just to kill. And Rip Torn just basically says to him, well, I don't agree with that, sir. I'm going to kill. I like killing.
He's like, I'll kill again.
Literally, that is literally his whole arc, pretty much.
I will kill again.
He's great in that. For me, my favourite trope is Patton Tanks filling in for any tank in any war movie. I absolutely love it. There's something about it. There are endless examples. Beach Red does it. Anzio does it. Pick a 50s war movie that there'll be a Patton.
Battle of the Bulge does it. Battle of the Bulge does it
because the Spanish had them.
Oh, and that giant silver Patton that it gets shown is my favourite part of that film.
So there's a train of thought for me. In the 50s, I think if you're getting a Department of Defense assistant, then you get Patton tanks given to you because it's what they've got. And then on the other hand, it's like, well, at that time, weren't Shermans being like scrapped and things like that? I always think there's a reason for this. It's not because they couldn't get them. It's because it was easily available. Yeah.
Yeah.
But I kind of just love it. I just like seeing it. It's like comforting. I don't know why. You know, it's
yeah,
it's just,
I mean,
it's,
that's it's, what made me laugh about Zissou was, you know, the fact they included that.
I love that, and the eternal argument.
It's their own bloody tank trope, isn't it?
Yeah, exactly. That's
kind of almost the same as the Patton.
Some people literally just go, "Well, the tank's wrong, so I can't watch the movie now." And I'm like, "What? What do you mean? Like, you wouldn't watch a war film if you didn't like the fact that one thing was wrong. You didn't watch them."
Very, very true. I mean, you know, you can become too obsessed with these things, I think.
Yeah. And I think that's why we love the tropes.
It's accounting for the dark side, almost.
Yeah, you lean too far in and then you start hating it, everything, every piece of media on whatever level.
What about worst tropes?
So worst trope for me, and this is more of a trope in overall cinema, because I just find it funny and it annoys me, where characters will be whispering for the benefit of the audience. But the whisper is a talking tone, like loud whisper. So you've got like, hey, like soldiers over there, like, you know, just trying to, you know, sort of example. But it might as well be me saying, there's soldiers over there. You would definitely hear it. It's just a trope that I don't enjoy because I know it's just for my benefit. And I'm like, yeah, but the person's within earshot, they'd hear you. Like, it's just, it always makes me chuckle.
No, that's a good one.
Sorry, and another one, and it's one we've talked about a lot, is ending cards of what happens to the characters if they're fictional.
Oh,
I can't stand it. I'm like, so they don't exist. It doesn't matter. Like,
they're not real people.
It doesn't matter. Yeah, exactly.
Don't do it. Yeah,
that's actually no scratch whispering. That is my most hated trope. Trying to make me overly care about a fictional character's after movie life. In the 90 minutes, that's their life to me. They don't exist outside that 90 minutes. I don't care.
Yeah, it's films assuming that you really, really love the character that much that you need to know what happened to them for the rest of their life.
I remember when I watched Football Factory for the first time and it did it. And I'm like, I don't fucking care what Danny Dyer and his gang of cliched hooligans do after this movie. Like, you worry that the director was thinking, you are insane if you think anyone cares about these people afterwards.
Mine is trying to disguise quarries as not quarries.
You love it. But you love it, though. See, we say we hate these things, but we love it as well.
It's a guilty pleasure, that one. I couldn't believe the Covenant did it to us. Like,
oh, that was so egregious.
It had a quarry combat scene. And I was just like, God damn it. It lives on. It really did. Yeah. And none of the guns you're using are actually live. So like, there's no possibility of like pyro or like firearms. Like,
no one's going to hurt themselves. Yeah.
Fired into a safe direction or something.
Yeah. Oh, there's a trope we haven't talked about as well. People doing shaky gun so they can put it on After Effects.
Shaky gun.
That's a cool thing.
That's an emerging trope. Last 10, 15 years, since CGI squibs and stuff.
In the wake of the way the industry seems to be going now, in the wake of the Ross incident, is that less, supposedly, I don't know who's picked this up and who's running with it, but supposedly that films are going to be using less real weapons, and any film that uses real firearms gets this piece written about them going, the movie makers defend the controversial decision to have firearms in their movies. And I'm like, well, if your movie's got guns in it, what can you do?
You can see what the end game of that will be. It'll be in like 10 years time. It'll be X director brings back firearms on set.
Yeah.
You know, it'll and be, it's like a big renaissance moment.
It'll be fucking Nolan, won't it? It'll make a biopic about Winchester or something. It'll be Winchester walking around going, oh, yeah. What have I done? I've made a repeating carbine that's going to destroy the world for like an hour and a half. We'd love to hate these tropes, don't we? And this is why we thought that we'd do this whole kind of episode, going through them a little bit, because as much as we can say, oh, I hate that, oh, that really pisses me off when I watch that movie, but it does make the experience, don't they?
It does make fun spotting.
Yeah, exactly.
Which is why we've done the trope tally in a couple of episodes. Yeah. But yeah, I mean, also it was a nice excuse to get some interaction from you guys. If you don't already follow us on Facebook, Twitter, Threads, yeah. OnlyFans, Instagram, definitely go and find us. We're on all of them as Fighting on Film.
You can find me on Letterboxd as well. I've dropped your Rob's review on down there. Just search my name, it'll come up if you want to. But yeah, so as always, thanks for joining us again for some more war movie chat. Next week will probably be a regular review. But, you know, as Matt said, do keep abreast of the social media and the ever-changing world of social media at the moment for all of your war movie updates, Threads and XYZ and the other. So, yeah, again, thanks for listening. Do catch the entire back catalogue of the show on fightingonfilm.com. Drop us a review on whatever you're listening on. We always appreciate it. And we'll catch you again next week for some more Fighting on Film.
Bye, guys.
Bye.
Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. Start getting your best night's sleep in these sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. Try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee. Plus, get 15% off your first order at bollandbranch.com. Code BUTTERY. Exclusions apply. See site for details.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. quince.com/style.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.